But in this case, we know that malware is looking for an IRC server, so we can give it that IRC server. I've got IRC installed on this box. To start it, type IRCD start. Type in the password, and the IRC server will be running in the background. Also, I have an IRC client here installed. It's configured to connect to localhost, to itself. So once you start the IRC server, start the IRC client as well by typing IRC. If you have your first X terminal window busy running Wireshark, then the way you can start another terminal window is by left-clicking on the desktop, selecting User Applications, and then selecting Extern. So I'm gonna go back to my Remnex box. IRCD start. This is gonna start the IRC server. It's gonna be running in the background. This IRC server is configured to listen on the common IRC ports like 6666 and 6667. And now I start the IRC client by typing IRC. And this IRC client is connecting to its own local IRC server. Why do I start the IRC client? Well, yeah, it's in anticipation of me figuring out what channel malware will try to connect to so that I can connect to that channel as well. Maybe I can interact with it. So once your IRC server is running, you can repeat your experiment. You can have your network sniffer running in the background. You can reinfect your system, and now you should be able to connect to your IRC server. And the question that you need to answer is, what channel is it connecting to? What nickname is it using? Are there any other meaningful connection parameters that I would include in my report? So, to just type IRC and it's going to start the IRC client. So IRCD start will start the IRC server, and to start the IRC client, you just type IRC and you press enter. And once your IRC server is running, make sure that your sniffer is running and repeat your experiment. What channel is it connecting to? What nickname is it using? I'll show you how I would do this in my lab. So I've got the IRC server running in the background. I'm gonna bring up Wireshark. By the way, I noticed that some of you are trying to, depending on, if you've been doing Unix for a while, then you have a tendency to go to switch to root, because that gives you the power, so you may have done, like, sudo bash to get a root shell. In this case, the way this environment is designed, stay as this user, because if you stay as this user, you've got all of the config files that I've prepared there to make things run nicely and smoothly for you. So don't switch to being root, unless you see me explicitly tell you so. So for example, Wireshark, it's an alias that I created that's gonna run it as root. It's going to prompt you for a password. It's using sudo behind the scenes. So I'm going to start capturing in Wireshark. I'm going to go to my lab, reinfect myself, and let it run for, in this case, actually just less than half a minute, and I can kill the malicious process. And now in Wireshark, I can pause capture and start looking at what's going on here. And in the very beginning of my capture, you start seeing packets going to port 6666. And now it's no longer, it's actually exchanging. There are a lot of packets flowing back and forth, so I know it's really communicating there. And my favorite feature of Wireshark, if I were to pick one, is probably the fact that I can click on any one of these packets associated with port 6666 activity, and I can say, follow TCP stream. And this shows me the payload from all the packets that are being exchanged as part of that session. And here I can see the nickname, and here I see the join command. So the nickname, in my case, is ODM. In your cases, it was probably different, right? And this is a way for us to confirm that it seems to be randomly generating those. Or maybe pseudo-randomly, maybe it's got some algorithm that's predictable. But my point is that this nickname is not something we can just plainly use as a network intrusion detection signature. But the join command might give us a good signature. It's a hard-coded word, presumably it's the word malware. And this is another way in which I customized this particular executable. I told it to use this channel. But this is the sort of information you're looking for. Wireshark makes it pretty easy for you to find it if you look at the session payload by following TCP stream. Any questions about this? Yeah. What now? Now that we've found out Oh, you know what? What now? 3 o'clock. Yeah, coffee time. So, how about this? We'll take a 20-minute break. If some of you have fallen behind or something didn't work, something got stuck, talk to me during the break. I'll help you troubleshoot. But we're going to resume in 20 minutes, and we'll do some... Pretty soon, we're going to do some code analysis of this thing. So let's get going. So where did we leave off? Well, we've just did some network sniffing and found the channel name that this particular program is using. Wireshark showed us that the channel that it's using is malware. How did I know this? Well, I looked at all the traffic that Wireshark has captured. I found that it's exchanging information on the TCP/IP session targeting port 6666, and I said, follow TCP stream. And that allowed me to see the payload of those packets, and I could see the join channel malware is in there. I also see the nickname, but the nickname keeps changing every time it generates a new session, so that one isn't all that useful to me. But the fact that it's joining malware is useful because now I can join that channel as well. How do I do that? Well, go back to your IRC client. If you want to see what channels are currently open on your server, type /list. If you want to join a particular channel, type /join. In this case, we know that the channel is named malware, so we're saying join malware. And remember, you have to specify the hash or the pound sign as well. Once you're on that channel, you can try interacting with the program by saying something in that channel. Of course, we don't quite know what to say, but maybe we can figure it out anyway. And this is on page 146 in your books. So let me see. In my IRC server, first of all, I can do /clear to clear the screen of some of the noise. /list will show me the commands. In this case, I don't have any commands. You know what? Because I guess I killed my malicious program. So let me rejoin the IRC server. You can run /list periodically. If you're waiting for the malware bot to join your IRC server, you don't really need the sniffer. You could just type /list, and you will see the new channel appear in the listing of the channels. So even if you're not running Wireshark, you can still type /list in your IRC client, and it's going to show you the channel that has been created. Now that I see that there's a channel malware that's created there, now I can join it by typing /join pound or hash malware. To see who is there, I can type /who pound malware. And I've got two users there. You see they're here on the third line on my screen. My user is named Remnix, and the user that represents the infected system in my example is GYKHGON. So it's me and the user that represents the infected system. If I had multiple infected systems here, then I would have multiple users. And as an attacker, now I would know what to type in this channel instead of, let's say, saying hello, which is going to be ignored probably. I would know what to type here to get some kind of a response or to trigger my bots to do my bidding. Now, we don't know what to type here, but you know what? I have had people taking this class before, and sometimes some folks have figured out that there are certain things they can type to get a response back. So let me give you just 1 minute to try that, if even that. Now, you may be able to get a response, not a very meaningful response, but it will be a way to confirm that it is possible to communicate with this thing. Excellent. So here's what Sachin did. All right. Anybody else got a response? Don't get too excited. It's not a very meaningful response, but it's something. So what Sachin did is he typed the word hello, and then he specified the nickname of the other guy. In my case, it's this catchy nickname, GYKHGON. And hey, I got a response back. It says, hello, Remnix. So I just typed hello, and then I got his nickname. See, it's listed on the top there. You can get a listing of people on this channel by typing /who pound malware. Very correctly, yeah. In fact, It will say, you know, la 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 la, regardless of what you say here, it's just going to echo it back. So la 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 remix. Yeah. Moo. You type moo. All right. So if you type moo, M-O-O, it's going to say moo remix. So again, as I said, not very meaningful conversation going on here. This is as primitive as it can get as far as language skills go. But it's encouraging. You can see that there is some way to interact with this beast. And if we figure out what the commands are, maybe we can get it to accept our instructions. Yeah. So how did you know to look for all those things? So you looked at some strings. So I don't want to go quite there yet, but yeah, we'll figure this out very shortly. Yes, somebody else had a hand? Okay. Yeah. So the way you know who the other user is it's going to be listed on the third line after you join the channel. So in this case, the other nickname is VHK. Yeah. It's a little, that's a little squiggly. That's his nickname. Yep. So in your case, it's just you, actually. So we know that there is a way to interact with this thing. The question is, how do we do it and what do we say? And that's what I want to answer by doing some code analysis. I want to take a short detour to mention a few things regarding another host name. I don't want us to do this as an exercise unless you're really fast with this sort of thing. There's another host name that it's continuing to try to resolve. It's called sb.webhub.org. Let me show you what happened in my system when I allowed it to resolve that other host name. So in my system, I also told it, if you're looking for sb.webhub.org, it's okay, you can connect to my Linux box, it won't mind. And I repeated my experiment, and now, in my sniffer log, at the bottom of the screen, you can see that now my infected system is trying to connect from port 80, which is typically used for web traffic, right? HTTP uses port 80. So, what's going on there? Well, right now, I get a response back that says, reset, I'm not listening on that port. I can start a listener there. Now, Remnix does have a web server installed on it. It's called TinyHTTPD. So if you wanted to have a full-fledged web server, there is a pretty good one, lightweight web server installed called TinyHTTPD. But I don't want to launch it right now because this is a chance to tell you about NetGet. And I have yet to attend the security course that does not mention NetGet. So I wanted to stay with that tradition and mention NetGet. It's a great tool. In this case, we're going to use it as a universal listener. So you can tell it to listen-l on port 80-p80. And now you can repeat my experiment, and now the malicious program is going to it's going to connect to my server. I'm going to have a listener there, and I can observe its connection parameters. And now I can see what it's trying to do. So what is it trying to do? It's connecting to a host that it thinks its name is sb.webhub.org. The first line of the packet says that it's trying to speak HTTP protocol version 1.1. This is a GET request, and it's trying to get slash, which basically means it's trying to get the first top-level page on that website. Now, take a look at the refer field. The refer field is supposed to tell the website who referred you here. That is, on which website did you click to arrive to me. And in this case, the referrer says that the user who came to sb.webhub.org, supposedly the user clicked on a link that was hosted on psychword.slack.org.au/cgibin/ads.cgi. This is strange, because there is no user doing any clicking here. What's the deal with psychword? Any theories what the referrer field might be about here? Maybe malware came from there, yeah. Maybe it's some kind of a password that's communicating with the attacker. Like, good things to think about, yeah. Yes, another theory. Maybe it won't respond unless the refer field is set to a specific value. Very good theories. I got another one that I want to share with you, but you're right. This is the sort of thinking that should be going on in your head. I think is a little bit strange here is that there's a reference to ads.cgi here. And if you think about the way a lot of the advertisers pay for throughout the websites for serving their ads, how do they know who deserves to get credit for the clicks? Let's say I want to bring people to my website. I got a website. I want more people to come there. I'm willing to pay each of you to host a banner ad on your personal websites, let's say. So you're going to host a banner ad on your website. Somebody's going to click on that ad. They're going to come to my site. I need to figure out who deserves a few cents for that referral. One of the ways in which I can do this is I can look at the referral field and I can say, oh, I see you came to me because you clicked on a link that was hosted on PsychWord. That's Slack.org. That's the guy who's going to get a few cents. So this very well could be a way for the malicious author to make some money by having his program to be clicking, pretending to be clicking on ads. So that's my working theory here, that this bot is infecting a lot of systems, and all of those systems are pretending to be clicking on ads, and sb.fact.org is paying money to whoever owns psychword.slack.org because it's thanking them for referrals. That's, in essence, how Google works, except that Google does not look at referrer field. It's got the same information embedded in the URL that the user clicks on. But it's basically the same kind of stuff. Right, this is advertising fraud. Yeah. Isn't it very easy? So you're right. I mean, you're thinking absolutely correctly, because if you're, let's say, law enforcement, you're trying to figure out who might be behind it, well, you could follow the money trail, right? You can say, well, sb.webhub.org, who's getting money here? Who's getting, or if you look at the ISP hosting this website, who's behind you? Yeah, very good, absolutely. You can follow the money trail, you may be able to find out who's the person behind this, absolutely, yeah. That's why I think this is pretty exciting. Although in many cases it's some kind of a fraudulent identity anyway, but at least there's a thread that you can start following. Yeah. And by the way, one more thing, the user agent string looks like it's fake because really I was not using Windows 98 to connect to the system when I took the screenshot, probably a hard-coded header. But this reference to advertisement spoofing was interesting to me. So, we've learned quite a bit about this program behaviorally. We learned the channel name that it uses on a particular host name and that it's using IRC. We found that there is some way to communicate with it, even though we couldn't figure out yet the commands. We also noticed that there's probably some advertisement-related activity associated with psychword.slack.org. And there's also this third host name that it's still trying to resolve, irc.slim.org.au. This one we have not pursued yet because that's going to be an exercise for later. But with the exception of this third host name, there's really nothing else that we can change about our environment to get it to do other things. That's when it's time to move to code analysis. So we've done some behavioral analysis. Let's look at code analysis to see what else we can learn about this program. And the way to start code analysis, I think, is to look at the strings embedded into the program. So please go back to your Windows virtual machine. Terminate your malicious process. Kill it if it's running. Be merciless. And then look at the strings embedded into this executable using bin text. You probably won't see many useful strings. And we'll go over why in a second. So I killed the malicious process. And then I'm going to drag and drop it into bin text so I can look at the strings. And there are some strings embedded in here, some, but actually less than one would expect. Not a lot. And the reason why we don't see a lot of strings is evident by looking at the strings embedded in the very top of the file. So take a look at what's on the top of the strings excerpt. There's a string in there that says, this file is packed with the UPX executable packer. And UPX is a very common packer. We're going to be looking at packers quite a bit in this course, because a packer is a program designed to compress or encrypt or obfuscate the original executable, so that the resulting file is protected, and we cannot easily figure out what it does. That's the bad news. The file is protected with UPX. The good news is that the file is protected with UPX, because UPX is the only packet that I know that has built-in reversal capabilities. It can undo its protection. UPX is an open source tool. You can download it from upx.org. And all you need to do to bypass its protection is to use UPX itself with a -d parameter. And that's going to decode it and unprotect it. The only packet that I know that does this, UPX. So it's good for us. And here's a strange thing. UPX, in the studies that I have seen, is by far the most popular packet that people use out there. Which is just bizarre, because there are so many others that are really hard to bypass. But if you look at the statistics that VirusTotal creates regarding what malware they see, by far the most popular packet is UPX. So we're going to look at UPX, because it's actually not a big deal for us to bypass, even if UPX-D does not work. Why do we want to bypass its protection? Well, first of all, we want to be able to look at strings. And if you tried to bring this executable into IDA Pro, it would get an error message. You'd get a warning. IDA Pro would complain. It would say that the import segment seems to be destroyed. This may mean that the file was packed or otherwise modified in order to make it more difficult to analyze. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're dealing with. But because this is UPX, please go to your command shell and type upx-d tnnbt.exe to decode this executable. And if it says unpacked one file, that means that it worked. And if it does not say that, well, let me know and I'll help you troubleshoot. UPX does not create a new file when it unpacks. It actually overwrites your original one. So the new file will still be called tnnbt.exe. But don't worry, we still have the original one on the CD. But yeah, it unpacks this one in place. Hackers is to make our job more difficult. If you take a packed executable and you try to analyze it in OliDebug or in IDA Pro, you will have a very hard time doing it. Because what the packer does is it takes the original executable and it compresses it or it encrypts it. And so the original executable is nowhere to be seen in clear text within the resulting executable file. But when the new executable runs, it'll unpack itself into memory. We're going to revisit this tomorrow in great detail. Right now, though, we're going to take advantage of the fact that UPX-D cleanly unpacks the executable, and we're going to take it from there. So now that you've unpacked this file, now load it into bintext again, and you should see many more strings visible to you than you could see before. Some of those strings will look like they are commands. And you can use these strings now to try to go back to your IRC server and try to interact with the bot. So here's what I would like you to do. After you've unpacked the executable, reinfect your system with the unpacked version of the bot. Allow it to join your IRC server. Then look at the commands that you will see as strings embedded into the program and try to see if any of them will work over the IRC channel. Just do a bit of experimentation. So if you're looking at the unpacked executable strings, you will see that there are a bunch of strings in there that all follow a similar pattern. All of the strings in there, their names will begin with the exclamation mark and with the at sign. That's an indicator that somehow these strings logically belong together. Also, most of those strings will be action verbs, like upgrade and run and clone and cycle. That's another indication that this might be a set of commands that the executable supports, maybe. So these are the strings that might be worth trying within your IRC session. So once you've located potential commands as string, don't trust that they're strings, validate them. So I'm going to infect my system with the unpacked version of the executable. And once it joins the channel, let me see, who, now where? Nobody yet. Oh, there it is. Once it joins my channel, now I can type those commands. Maybe exclamation mark at sysinfo. Notice that the strings have to start with the exclamation mark and with the at sign. Why? Well, that's how the author of the program created his bot. That's part of the command, the exclamation mark and the at sign. So you need to remember to include them as well. In other bots, the author decides to follow a different convention. You learn from what you see in the strings. And in this case, I typed sysinfo, and I got nothing. Let me try that again. All right, so something isn't working in my case. Maybe I'm not on the channel. So it's not working in my lab for some reason. I shouldn't need to leave the channel, but you know what? Let me try this one. Okay. Alright. So something was screwed up, but I exited the IRC client, came back in, and now it's working. So I typed sysinfo with the exclamation mark and the at sign, because that was one of the strings embedded into the executable that looked like it might be a command. And look, I actually got a response back. It gives me information about the infected system, like the fact that it's a genuine Intel processor running Windows XP. And its uptime is about 3 hours and 15 minutes. All right, so now we've got... Now, this is a bit more meaningful than moo and la la la. So now, another command that I saw worked was ID. ID. ID gives me some identifying information about the bot. It says that this is Slackbot, version 1.0, running for about 2 minutes. But there are some commands that don't seem to work, like the command that I tried was run, let's say I want to run Notepad. And when I press Enter, it just ignores me. Maybe because I got the wrong syntax. Or maybe because this is a privileged command for which I need to be authenticated. You might have noticed that among the commands supposedly supported by the bot is the command login. Also, there's a string pass accepted. That suggests to you that there is an authentication mechanism that's probably password-based that we'll need to figure out if we want to fully control this bot. Any questions about this so far, about this process of finding the strings and validating them? Notice that I'm not taking these strings at a face value. I always try to validate to confirm that they indeed work and that they're not just there to confuse me. All right, well, so here's what I would like to do. I would like to do a bit of code analysis to understand how to control this bot. Specifically, there is indeed a password-based authentication mechanism here that I want to crack. And I want to show you how to do that through some code analysis. And here's what I'm going to do. And if you'd like to follow along, you can do it in the lab, or I'm going to show you this on the screen as well. What I'm going to do is I'm going to load the malicious executable into IDA Pro. So if you're following along, terminate the malicious process and then load it into IDA Pro. Because we are looking at the unpacked version of the program, IDA Pro should have no problems parsing it. And if IDA Pro asks you any questions about how to load the program, just accept the defaults. So here's the program, and theoretically we can just keep scrolling down and seeing what's going on, but you know what, that's not a very efficient way of looking through the program. There's a lot of code here that's not all that meaningful to me. So instead what I want to do is I want to do a search for a string that I know I'm interested in. Because here's how I'm going to do this. I would like to understand how the login command works. Because that's an interesting command for me to understand. That's authentication. If I can break through authentication, I will have complete control over this bot, and I can learn about its potential. The login command might be a little bit complex for me to understand. So instead, I'm going to start with something a little bit simpler, like the command ID. I know ID works because I just tried it. I know that it works without any parameters, without any authentication. So I'm going to find a block of code that is responsible for the ID command. And I'm going to understand how it works. Then, once I've understood that, I can look at a more complex command like login to figure out how that command works. And hopefully, this will allow me to crack the authentication mechanism, which is the goal of this particular exercise. The easiest way to find the string is to press Alt-T in IDA Pro. Alt T is one of those shortcuts that you will find documented on the cheat sheet that I handed out, and it's a text search. And it's one of my favorite features of IDA Pro. It's just as simple as the text search. It's very reliable. And so I'm going to do Alt T and say exclamation mark at sign ID. And this brings me to this block of code responsible for the ID command. And now I can see how does it work. Let me show it to you as a screenshot because it's going to be a little bit easier to see, I think. Let's understand this. I mentioned to you that if you're looking at a block of code, if you're not sure where to begin, start with a call statement. And there's a call here on the top. We have the name of the function, it's strcomp. And you can Google it, and you'll find out that strcomp is one of the ways of comparing two strings. Strcomp, it's a string comparison function. It compares two strings that it expects to receive as its parameters. That's why before call to strcomp, you see the two push instructions. It's pushing the two strings that it's going to compare. A comment that we see, one of those strings is the string ID. Not surprising. That's why we're in this block of code, because it is referencing that string. So it's comparing the string ID with another string. I also mentioned to you that it's worth looking at the jump instructions. They begin with a J character. Here it is. JNZ stands for jump if not zero. It's a conditional jump. We're going to cover conditional jumps in some detail on the third day of the class. But let me explain to you what's going on here. You've got a string comparison. It compares two strings. If string comparison finds that the two strings are equal, it returns zero. If it finds that the two strings are not equal, it says it's not zero. JNZ will jump if not zero, which means it's going to jump if the two strings are not equal. That's the meaning of this block of code. So it's comparing two strings, and if they're not the same as each other, it's going to jump to location 401C53. Why is that relevant to us? Well, we're trying to understand what this block of code might be doing. And to do that, we're putting on the attacker's hat, or rather, the hat of the programmer of this program, and the hat is probably colored black. So, if you're a programmer, and you're writing a bot that understands multiple IRC-based commands, a command like login, ID, sysinfo, run, how would you create that block of code? Well, you probably have a bunch of comparison statements, or a switch statement, that says, I got this command from the IRC server. Let me compare it to all the possible command values that I understand to determine what this command is and how I need to handle it. So it looks at the command that it received from the IRC server, and it compares it to ID. And if the two strings match, then it's going to do whatever ID is supposed to do, like tell the user that it's running for about 3 minutes or so. If the two strings don't match, then it jumps elsewhere, probably, to perform more string comparisons so that it can say, okay, so this command that I got, it's not ID. Is it login? Is it sysinfo? Is it run? And so on and so forth. So what we've got here is a little block of code that is trying to determine whether the command that it received is the ID command. And if it is ID command, it's going to do whatever ID is supposed to do. For example, notice there's a call to time. You might recall that when I issued the ID command, it told me I've been running for 3 minutes. How does it know that? Probably, when the program began running, it created a timestamp. What time was it when it began running? And every time it receives the ID command, it says, well, what time is it now? And it subtracts the two timestamps to determine that it's been running for 3 minutes. So this is what this block of code is about. It receives a command from the IRC channel. It compares that command to the command that this block of code is responsible for. And if the two strings don't match, then it jumps elsewhere to do more string comparisons. If it does not jump elsewhere, then it executes the code associated with this command. Any questions about that? Well, let's take a look at this in another context. Because now we're looking at a very similar block of code, but this one is responsible for the more interesting command called login. How did I find it? Well, I did a text search for login. So if I do Alt-T, login, it'll bring me to this block of code, which is what I'm showing you on this slide. Now, the beginning of this code is exactly the same as what I showed you earlier. Now, the command that it received from the IRC server is still one of those parameters that are not visible to us statically, but presumably it's comparing it to the string login. And if the two strings match, then it's going to do whatever login is supposed to do. The question is, how does login work? What is this? If we can understand this, then we can figure out how to crack it. Well, there's the string at the bottom of the screen capture. The string might not be visible to those of you sitting in the back. It says pass accepted. That's a good-looking string because it suggests to you that whatever happened above, it accepted the password. So the question is, under what circumstances will it say pass accepted? Well, let's work backwards. Let's zoom in on this last portion of the code. Here it is. So at the bottom here, it says pass accepted. And we're going to work backwards to see when will it say pass accepted, or when will it say, when won't it say pass accepted. Immediately above that sweet, sweet looking string is another command called JNZ. JNZ is a conditional jump. We know it's a jump because it begins with a J. JNZ means jump if not zero. Jump if what is not zero? Well, ultimately, it depends on the result of a strcomp above. There's a call to strcomp. It's comparing two strings. We actually don't see the value of those strings when we look at them statically, but we can think about what they might be. Let's think about it. It's comparing two strings. If they are equal to each other, that means that strcomp will return zero, which means that this jump will not be taken, which means that it's going to say pass accepted. So it's comparing two strings, and if they're the same, it's going to say pass accepted. What do you think it's comparing? Yeah, it's comparing the password that it received from the user with the password that it expects. And if the two match, it's going to say pass accepted. So that's a good insight, because now we can figure out what password is it expecting. We actually have several ways of trying to crack this authentication mechanism. I'm going to show you one tomorrow and one today. The method that I want to show you today is the following. We can use OliDebug to set a breakpoint. And what I want to do is set a breakpoint on this strcomp, because this strcomp is comparing two strings, and one of those strings is the password that it is expecting to see. So if I set my breakpoint here and I run the program, I can try authenticating to it using a meaningless password as long as I trigger this breakpoint. And if I trigger this breakpoint, I should be able to use OliDebug to see the value that it pushed to the stack. That value should be the password that it is looking for. That's how we're going to approach this. So let me show you how to do this on my screen, and I'm going to give you some time to try this in your lab. And, of course, also the instructions are in your book. Now, by just personal choice, I like using OliDebug to do this kind of dynamic analysis, even though you could use a debugger built into IDA Pro to do this. But I like OliDebug, so I'm going to launch OliDebug. This is my debugger. Now, to debug a program in it, I need to load the program that I want to debug. So I'm going to go to File and say Open. Now, I'm going to load a copy of KNNVTIB into OliDebug. Now, listen carefully, because about 15% of you will get this wrong. Which executable will I load? Your first instinct is probably to go to your desktop and load it from the desktop. Don't do that. Because if you do that, here's what's going to happen. You're going to load it, but as soon as you try running it, at the bottom right corner, you're going to see terminated. It won't work, and here is why. This particular specimen, what it does is the following. If it runs outside of the Windows directory, all it does is it copies itself into Windows, and launches that one from the Windows directory. And OliDebug cannot follow along. So the general idea is launch it from the same location where it would have launched itself from. And if you remember how defined its registry key, it is running from the Windows directory. So here's all you need to do. Now, run it from the Windows directory, but I just infected myself, so let me kill that other one that's running in the background. OliDebug, file, open, but I go to the Windows directory. My computer, C, Windows, kinemb-tib. All right. Now I loaded the executable into OliDebug. At the bottom right corner, OliDebug says that it's paused. That's good. Usually, OliDebug will be paused because now is our chance to set our breakpoints. Where do we set the breakpoint? Well, if you just scroll down here, eventually you will see that block of code that is associated with the login string, but that's very time-consuming. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to my IDA Pro analysis, and I will remember that the code that I'm interested in is at the address 4020B9. You may want to write that down. 4020B9. Well, the best way to search for it that I find is based on its address. Now, I know you're saying, why not search in OliDebug for the string login? I tell you, searching in OliDebug is horrible. It never works the way it should. I always get it wrong. It's very unpredictable, so I try to stay away from it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Well, and we should be running the unpacked version. Now, we loaded the executable from the Windows directory. Remember, we've already unpacked it on the desktop, and then we infected ourselves once. When we infected ourselves with the unpacked version, it copied the unpacked version into the Windows directory. So the one that we're loading from Windows should be already unpacked. I don't like searching in OliDebug for strings. It never works the way I think it should. So I do my searching in IDA Pro. I find the memory address, 4020B9, and then I go into OliDebug. I can scroll down to that address, or I can press Control-G. Control-G stands for go to. It's one of the shortcuts on your cheat sheet. And now I can say go to 4020B9, and it goes there, and here is that block of code that we've just been looking at, as seen through OliDebug. Yes. Once you've unpacked it, the MD sum and MD5 sum would be different. Because it's like you've unzipped the file. Yeah, the file is going to be larger usually. It's going to be a very different MD5 sum. Yeah. Well, for this analysis, we're operating on the unpacked program. That's because, remember, we unpacked it on the desktop. We infected ourselves with the unpacked version. It copied itself into Windows. So, yeah, for now, we're dealing with the unpacked one. Tomorrow, I'm going to show you some of the intricacies of how you would do this with the packed version.